So, welcome to today's virtual machines. Last time we have had a lot of content for object orientation, creating classes and constructors and all that, and there's just one last bit that we still need to go on about, and that is how to insert the call to an parent constructor into our concepts. So let's have a look at how that works out. So the idea is to have constructs of this form here, where we mention an earlier constructor to be called, and since this has to be carried out before the code for the actual current constructor call, this has to be somehow inserted into the code for A itself before the body is finally executed. So how that works is then that you just insert the actual you insert the actual call to the earlier constructor like this, of course together with marking and popping together, and do that in the context of the memory region that you have provided before, together with the parameters from here that are evaluated directly in the preamble of the actual current constructor. And afterwards, since within the constructor for B, there will usually be the virtual table for B classed object found within the reserved memory area, we then afterwards override that with the pointer to the virtual table to A before we then actually continue on with execute or generating the code for the constructor A itself. So that is kind of the concluding thing for the object-oriented machine. This thing I don't want to talk about. So then the next idea of extending the concepts that we already had before in the way that we have extended the C machine for objects would be to present an extension that adds thread support to the C machine with a concept of not actual concurrent execution, but parallelism, in the sense that you switch from the execution of one thread to the execution of another thread in sequence, in that sense. So you linearize a parallel system in that. So this is kind of the first step of parallelizing code. The more you want to introduce concurrency, the more you have to pay attention to actual races introduced in hardware. And if you're more into those things, then you will probably have to go a little bit deeper into the actual properties of memory, of memory hierarchies, how caches interact with each other, how caches that are bound to particular cores interact with each other, and how they somehow maintain some kind of reliable system. So this is a different topic. This is more on how to deal with finding these parallelism instructions in high-level code and to introduce some kind of semantics for that. So the actual parallelization in terms of concurrent execution would be thinkable as kind of an optimization of what we find, what we present here. So anyway, let's start right into that. The features that we want to introduce for this part of the lecture are, well, we call them the threaded C language, which is just an extension of the C that we have seen before with new instructions for creating a new thread, for terminating a particular thread. You can also wait for the for another thread to actually have terminated its computation and return some result, and facilities for mutual exclusion with lock and unlock. So the question would now be, how can we somehow extend the virtual machine for the CIMA without breaking a lot of the code that we have already specified before? So what can be reused to a certain degree? Well, for sure there's a need for some code store with the program counter. This should be something that we can reuse. Also, heap is something that we usually consider to be transparent throughout all the threads, so you can exchange ideas of addresses in the heap between threads even. So what we can carry over from CIMA are things like the code store and the program counter we already said, as well as heap and new pointer in order to get an idea of where to append every thing that we need to store. So turned out that this area of the lecture was added on quite some time after the first part had been introduced. So during that time, I think Helmut had realized that things like the extreme pointer was actually handled not the way that we presented in CIMA in newer codes, but instead you would rather go over to a segmented view on memory and don't have a behavior like the one that he feared in the beginning, such that the stack and the heap would grow into each other. And since for this thing here now, we keep apart stacks for each of the threads that we maintain on the machine, turns out that we can't really think of stacks and heaps as things that still can grow into each other anymore, since there's several stacks now on the machine. So these old ways of classical view on stack and heap growing into each other have been abandoned for this thing anyway. So yeah, there you go. Extreme pointer is not the harsh limit that we had before. So for growth of stacks, you don't have to check whether it grows into the heap anymore. Instead, we somehow only keep the extreme pointer, I think, for in a way that we just check whether the new pointer somehow exceeds the maximum limit of the heap at some point, and that is kind of the only protection for running out of memory. Maybe there's also some check for the stack growing out of its available memory, but yeah, that is not covered anymore in here. So the actual changes that are now perceived is that the store now, of course, still keeps the heap, but also a set of stacks instead of a single stack anymore. So in this data structure, we keep a stack for each of the threads that we manage throughout the runtime of a program. And we have a stack pointer and a frame pointer pointing to the particular locations in the respective stack for the currently running thread. So the things that differ from FEMA in that sense then are that we now have this S-set concept, which is the set of stacks. And so that is what we've seen before. This S or store area now is a common address space for heap and all the stacks, so that we have, from a typing point of view, we can just talk about addresses in general and don't have to directly care about whether we come or we get this address from stack A or stack B or even from the heap. And yeah, those pointers, stack pointer and frame pointer, now point not to the stack pointer but to a stack pointer, the one from the current topmost occupied stack cell, and respectively the same thing goes for the frame pointer. So this is also pointing to the current stack frames location. Yeah. So that is that. And of course there's also the thing that I mentioned, for simplicity we omit the extreme pointer. Also in practical terms, this is a concept that is outdated a little bit with the introduction of segments in memory. So this is not so strictly necessary anymore. Yeah. So apart from just the stack duplication for each thread, what else we add is the so-called ready queue. So the ready queue abstracts a concept for keeping book of all the threads that are waiting for execution. So since we still emanate from points of view of semantics from a single core machine, we can only execute one instruction at a time. So as soon as we start several threads, we will have unexecuted threads that are interested in getting their share of the execution time. And in order to keep them registered, we introduce this concept of a ready queue. And the way that we represent threads in there is that every thread is considered to be represented through a unique number, which we call the thread ID, or TID for short. And this thread ID is related to the actual corresponding thread by means of a particular table called the thread table, TTAB, that maps the TID to the support data for the corresponding thread. Apart from that, we've learned that at every point in time there can be several executable threads, but only one that is actually really executed or run by the processor. So several ones in the ready queue, one currently running. So that is the machine model for this thing. And this has been kind of the dominant machine model for a long time, until we had the sudden rise of the multi-core machines a few years ago. So what else do we need? We need some way of actually telling accessing the concept of the idea of what is actually currently running. So for these purposes, we add a register to the virtual machine that keeps this information. So this is the current thread register, CT, and this keeps the thread ID of the currently running thread. And in order to, for example, realize some forks in your program code, there is some function. For our purposes here, it's called the self function that returns the thread ID of the current thread. So for that purposes, we have this self expression here, which is implemented via special purpose instructions, and you will meet a lot of special purpose instructions in this chapter. So yeah, this is the self one, that is the one that just returns the content of the current stack register. So this information goes on top of the stack. So with that, you can create kind of forking things depending on which thread you currently are, in that sense. So the remaining executable threads are maintained in the ready queue that we already mentioned. So what we have is the current thread register and the ready queue that somehow lives in the virtual machine and contains in a queue, that so it grows arbitrarily. And then we have this global structure, the thread table, that can be used to look up the data for each thread under the thread ID. So you can index this table with thread ID. So yeah, you see that the current thread register as well as the ready queue contain fields which are interpreted as indices in the thread table. So they somehow are linked to the thread table via the ID that they are carrying and thus point to threads somehow. So what else do we need to work with this kind of system and at some point maybe even switch from one thread to the other? Well, we need to somehow access the thread queue, be it either adding a new thread to the queue with the NQ or obtaining a thread from the queue via the DQ thing. So these are methods that are offered on the level of the runtime. So the runtime needs to implement them. That's why they are printed in black here. So in an example, what could happen is that we could in queue 13 to the ready queue. So 13 would be a viable thread ID, thus has an entry in the thread table. And if we enqueue it to the ready queue, this just works in the way that we append another item at the end of the ready queue and fill it with the identifier of a thread in the thread table. And likewise, we might do a DQ operation, and if we want to switch to that particular thread, we would fill the current thread pointer with the thing that we obtain from ready queue. Could do so by setting CT to DQ, which would first of all remove the old reference from CT and then remove the first element from the ready queue, let CT point to that thing now, and be done with that. So this is the idea of working with that. There's, of course, also the possibility that a call to DQ fails if there is no ready queue left, ready thread left. In that case, we would return a negative value, which would mean that this is not a valid thread ID. So the question is now, what is needed to be kept in the thread table in order to uniquely identify a particular process? So we said that what we have replicated for each of the threads would be the stack, for once. So probably the stack-related registers somehow need to be different between the respective threads. So we keep, of course, for once, the stack pointer itself in the thread table. And then there's also the frame pointer, which is related in the sense that it also shares the concept of having a particular stack. So this is also kept in the thread table. And then there is the thing that we might have different code actually run in those threads, and this is usually the default thing. So we should probably also keep a pointer to the next executable instruction in the thread table in order to, yeah, to know where we want to continue with that particular thread in case it is suspended. So, if we want to at some point interrupt the execution of our thread due to probably a change of execution of threads, then we will probably want to keep the information in the thread table to the most recent version that we have had during execution. So we will probably update the values in there, and for that we introduce this save function that is once again a runtime thing, and this will just back up the relevant registers into the according entries in the thread table. So the first index is with the current thread ID. So this goes via the CT register. And then the second index is the actual field in the entry in the thread table, and there's three of them for the frame pointer, the program counter, and the stack pointer. When we switch between different threads, we might, after we have saved our current status of execution, we might want to at some point do the actual switch to the other thread, and this can be done by restoring the values that we have at some point saved into the thread table, and therefore we also need this restore function that accesses the backup versions of our frame pointer, program counter, and stack pointer, and just retrieves them from the thread table. So with all this instruments now being there, we can start working on an actual switch between threads, and this is a thing that we do with an actual instruction on the virtual machine, which is this yield thing, which then executes the thread switch by doing combining all the means that we have had so far. So there is the first idea of, well, checking whether there are actual threads waiting in the in our ready queue. We can do so by first of all extracting a thread ID from the ready queue, and if that is a non-negative value, then this has already removed a ready thread from this queue, so we now need to switch to that. So for the for these cases, what we do is we first of all save our old status, and then make sure that we enter the ready queue for some later point in time to resume execution. So this is done with the in queue of the current thread register in the ready queue. Then we overwrite the current thread ID with the one that we have extracted from the ready queue beforehand. And then we continue on by restoring the stack management register and the program counter from the thread table. So, yeah, with that, we get everything for thread switching, in the sense that we replace the current thread with one from the ready queue, if there is one. So, now that we know how to do an actual thread switch, we might wonder, when do we do that? And yeah, there's the problem out there that we want to have give fair chances to all the threads that there are to be actually computed. And yeah, this comes from the time when there was not an actual automated mechanism for that, and people would rely on the programmer to actively put yield instruction actively into the source code in order to gently hand over the priority of computation to some other thread. And, well, you can imagine that a system where you let the user control such things will, particularly in multi-user environments, pretty quickly escalate into a very fierce fight for computation time. So you would like to have that rather automated. So what you would like to have on such a machine is that every thread that is at some point created is at some point really scheduled for running, and every thread, no matter which one, will at some point be interrupted and well, descheduled, and has to wait for another opportunity again. So yeah, the first thing that we have already had this anecdote about is this explicit call to function yield, which with varying success, so to say. So this is a thing that is probably yeah, is out there, but relies on people to be actually really cooperative and really support the idea of multi-threading on a multi-user machine. So yeah, that is this idea. Of course, you would you could go the lazy way and say that everyone is permitted one instruction, and then we have to switch around, or some other fixed number of instruction. Well, if you choose this number of instructions very low, for example, after every instruction, this will probably end up in a very expensive systems in terms of wasted computation time, since for each of the thread switches, you will have to check for a new thread being in the ready queue, and if there is, you will have to exchange three registers and reset the current thread pointer, and yeah, so there's always a constant overhead of things to be done after every ordinary instruction, which will kind of slow down your machine quite a lot. You could also have the system count the number of instructions, maybe even try to do that a little bit more by giving certain instructions a certain weight depending on what they all do on machines. So things like composite instructions that have actual sub-instructions that are implemented for that might be more expensive than simple arithmetic instructions, for example. But anyway, for such a thing, you would have to install some kind of counter and add this overhead to your execution and then execute yield dynamically at whenever your counter exceeds a particular value. And yeah, you could do so, but this still needs some work at runtime, and you pay with runtime for this type of facilities, or have to put extra hardware into your system for that. So what can we do from a point of view of a compiler? We could try to anchor particular yields into the system at points where we usually consider that there is has already been a lot of time dedicated to a particular user, and he still will be continuing to do so. And yeah, so the concepts that are usually out there that will create a lot of time of execution time being allocated for a particular user are, well, if you only have a particular code size, you will have to at some point reuse code that you have written by some means. And this is usually, well, meaning that there's only so many things that you can do there. You can, for example, have loops in the sense that you at some point jump back to some earlier point in your program and reuse the fraction of code since then until you might as well jump back. So back jumps are usually a thing with which you prolong your execution time. And also the other thing that you can do is probably things like recursion. So these are the two concepts out there that prolong the execution time with respect to a particular code size. So the idea would be to intervene at each of these situations by particular means and place hard-coded yields in your generated code just by a compiler, and this might support the switching of threads quite a lot. So what you would choose as suitable locations for placing yields then would be probably at the beginning of function bodies. So this would catch the notion of recursion, and then the other thing was to catch things like loops. You would like to catch back jumps, and this is the thing that you can easily do before adding a jump instruction that targets an address that is actually smaller than the current program counter. Then you can add another yield into the system. So this is then a situation where you don't have a yield after each instruction. You don't have to somehow count how many instructions you have. But still, you would have some means of bounding the execution time that a particular thread is receiving just by means of, well, recursion and loops being the ones that prolong execution. So what you would have to do or modify for things like loops would then be following things. So you see that there's this jump A, which is a back jump in that sense. This would have to be extended by a new instruction yield that would add the desired thread switch after each iteration of the loop. Now, the thread switch that you see added in this iteration of the code would, of course, mean that after each body execution of the loop, you would switch threads. This might be a thing that is still a little bit too harsh in terms of runtime overhead for thread switching. So you might not want to have something like this. So, well, you can have several ideas to mitigate that. For example, you could still just count every invocation or execution of such a yield thing, and then set a particular threshold for whenever you would do an actual real switch. So, for example, you could only switch threads after every nth call of yield, like every 100th call of yield, and still in these loops, for example, you would at some point hit a situation where then an actual yield would really occur. You could also, for example, do things like loop unrolling. I don't know whether that is known to you, so this is an optimization that is usually performed after the naive code generation. So for certain situations when you can certify particular properties for a loop, you can duplicate or replicate the body of the loop several times and reduce the expressions that are there for controlling the actual back jump in a way that you can still uphold the semantics of the original program. And this is this loop unrolling. This will essentially just replicate the code of the loop over and over and over again. And you can have a particular threshold for how large you want a particular linear piece of code to be before you do an actual jump, and can somehow play around and optimize a little bit, and then have, for example, 8 iterations of the loop being unrolled before there's an actual real back jump added again. And this might also reduce the number of thread switches quite a lot by adding by multiplying with a particular factor, for example. So this will also somehow reduce the thread switches in there. Yeah. So the only thing that then remains is these some go to instructions or some other freely programmed uses of the jumps, which also need thread switches before the jump. So this is how you can make sure that there is actual switches between threads happening. Now, how do I actually really generate situations where I have threads? For this, I need to, at some point, create representations of threads. So this is what we do here. So we have the statement or expression in this case, create. That is there for creation of a thread that has the purpose of executing a particular piece of code under a particular context. So for that, we have in this very abstract view two parameters. One meant to be the pointer to the code to be actually executed, and this is for our purposes here, considered to be a function, function address. And the second expression giving us a particular idea of what the parameterizing context of that would be. And here you see this being just one expression, but you can probably assume that you could also fit through arrays, structures, or whatever, an arbitrary amount of parameters to your thread. So this is just to give you an idea of what to do with the parameters later on, and in a practical system you would probably have different ideas of how to create threads. Particularly in C, I think you don't have a create expression like this, but rather just duplicate your current program counter in that sense and have to do this forking to the actual code that you want to execute manually anyway. But for our purposes here, we have such a thing. There's also the notion of thread creation failing due to running out of space for threads, maybe. I don't know. Depends on the actual implementation of the machine. And for that, you would have the return value minus one from create. And otherwise, the identifier representing the thread as the new return value. So thinking a little bit about that, what are the things that we would actually have to do in order to generate code would be, of course, we need to at some point get an idea of what this the EIs are. So we need to evaluate the actual parameters as well as the function to execute. We'd have to put together all the necessary means to actually execute those things by assembling a new runtime stack, first allocating that, and then somehow link that to, or prepare that to start the evaluation of the actual function together with the parameter. We need to create a new thread ID for the newly introduced thread. We need to make sure that this thread is actually correctly mapped with the thread table, and insert the thread ID finally into the ready queue for the next yield to, at some point, or not the next, but some yield in the future, to actually redispatch to that particular thread. So how to do that is seen here. So there's the things that we already know how to do. This is the evaluation of the two parameters, E0 and E1. To be found on the stack then, and for all the other purposes, we introduce this init stack and the init thread. For the init stack, first of all, preparing all the necessary data structures in the store, while the init thread then prepares this newly created stack space on in the store for executing the desired function. So, in order to obtain the init the stack at some point via init stack, we need some runtime support again in order to create stack. So this is what the black new stack is supposed to do. So this is a thing that will create a new bottom of the stack out of nothing, and then points to this new stack pointer from the top of the stack of the currently running thread. So if that fails, then zero comes out of that. Then there is init stack, which would then prepare the stack in a way that it can actually be used. So first of all, of course, there's the new stack to be created. Then we continue with the case that there is actually a bottom of stack provided. This is when the top of stack is not zero. In case that it is actually zero, then the this init stack then will return minus one for the create thing, which is done with this minus one down there. But in case that it is successful, it will then prepare the whole thing a little bit in the sense that we will already preset a few fields of the stack. Yeah, with what we see is minus one, f, and the thing that we have found on top of the stack, which will we'll see a little bit later on what all these things are. Particularly this f thing is not to be confused with the actual function to be dispatched to, but in that case here, this is a hardwired address that is also part of the runtime, that is a fixed code for the termination of threads. So I don't know, this was very uncreative to use the F again here. So this is hand-tailored code that will be there for each of the bottom of stacks and is can be reused in order to get rid of the actual stack again. So this is not the same F as the F from here. Okay? Yeah, the minus one that you've seen is the one that you that would usually contain the frame pointer or the frame pointer of the predecessor. But since this is the bottom of the stack, this will have to be predecessor-less. So there is minus one in there. The extreme pointer is not there anymore, so this is a thing that we don't have to take care of. So, so much for this thing. The other thing is then, oh yeah, we have to at some point manage the threads in a way that we don't confuse them with each other, so we need to somehow centrally keep book of all the threads that we have already created, in the sense that we need to disambiguate all the IDs that we have so far given to the threads. And this is usually done with some kind of a global counter in free programming, and in terms of virtual machines, this would mean that we need another register that keeps book of the so far used thread IDs, and this is the thread count register, TC, which is initially zero and incremented usually during thread creation. So this is what we now do during the initialization of the thread. So this emanates from an already created new stack frame, which is prepared for execution with this bottom elements like the invalid old frame pointer, and the termination code is continue code. And yeah, so what init thread does now is it links the things that are found on top of the stack, which is the continuation address for the thread together with the parameters, to the newly created stack stub. And yeah, so how that is done is what you find here. So the situation is that we have the pointer to the current thread at, on top of the current stack, or not the current the new thread, but the new thread's stack, of course. And then there is the continuation address directly following down there. So this is the situation before, and also there is the old thread counter. So what init thread now does?
Yes.
It first of all checks whether the pointer to the stack is actually a valid one. And if it is so, the first thing to do is the thread counter is immediately incremented in order to actually really have a valid thread ID, with which we then fill the thread table with the according information. So thread ID from 0 to 2 is set with all the important stuff, like initializing the stack pointer and the frame pointer to the top of the currently pointed to stack, and the program counter to be used for continuation of the thread is initialized from whatever we have evaluated beforehand for this thing. So this is obtained from there, and after that is done, the thread itself is then represented on top of the stack instead of everything else with thread ID. So this points now to the thread table over here. And the only thing that now remains to do is to make sure that this is eventually really executed. So we have to append an entry to the ready queue, and this is what we do with the NQ thing. So that is what follows the creation of the new stack frame with the init thread thing. So much about the actual beginnings of lifetimes of threads. Now what follows is what is to be done when the thread needs to be terminated. So, well, for our purposes, a thread usually returns some value. And what else happens is that there's two ways of terminating a thread usually. Of course, there's a normal one where you at some point run out of code to actually really execute. So that is usually done when the function call that is associated with the create is terminated, and the return value of this thing is then usually the return value of the call itself. Then the other way of exiting a particular thread would be the explicit call to this exit facility with a particular expression as parameter, which would return the evaluation of the expression as the return value of this thread execution. And after that, it would just pop everything that is on the stack and ignores that. So in this world, we can use then as the place for to find the return value of the function being the bottom stack cell. So after thread has been terminated, there's no other use for the stack anymore, so we can just reuse that as the return value. This is what you have already said. Exit can occur somewhere inside, so we can then just deconstruct every stack frame, and after everything is deconstructed, we can then terminate everything by jumping to this general purpose cleanup routine at address F, which is still a mystery for us here. So in order to then support something like that, we can first of all look at what a thing like exit does. So this is first of all, of course, evaluating the expression E old school, and then what would be followed. Following that is three new instructions for the virtual machine, like this exit term next, with term being a thing that we will for now not cover. So this is a thing that you might ignore at that point. Instead, let's just focus on exit and next. So exit is this process of sliding down the complete stack of that particular thread. So what this would do is then first of all obtaining the result from the top of the stack. That's how the code generation has provided the result of E, and then we would just dismantle the whole thing by going down the chain of predecessors of frames until at some point we reach the situation that the frame pointer is -1, which was this invalid predecessor, and that is then the situation when we have completely deconstruct the stack, and what we can then do is we can then set the result into the remaining stack cell, and yeah, with that we have stored the return value at the appropriate point in memory. So this is what exit does. So yeah, this just leaves the stack with the resulting value like this, and removes everything in between. And yeah, that is that. The next thing would be to then make sure that the next executable thread is activated. Yeah, this is a thing that is pretty similar to what the yield has actually really done, just with the difference that the current thread is not re-entering the ready queue, since the current thread is terminated anyway. So what usually happens is that just the current thread will be gone from there and replaced with the thing that is found in the ready queue, with this DQ thing, and also the content that is found in there goes into the actual management registers and replaces the ones from thread 4. So that is what the next then does. And of course, if there is no thread to actually really resume, then the DQ will return an invalid address. And this is then a situation where we have terminated the complete program. So there's nothing else to compute anymore. This is a situation where we then usually would return the result of the original program. And yeah, this is what the halt then does. This just terminates execution, and stack pointer already points to the correct cell, and this is what is given back to the operating system then. And well, in case that there is still things to execute, what we then do is what we then do is save and restore the thread from the CT variable that which we have used for getting the next thread in queue, and then restore its innards without enqueuing our current CT. So you might wonder what we can do next. Well, there's still a lot to do. For example, waiting for termination of particular threads. So this is the first kind of communication thing between particular threads. So what we usually find in programs that use such a behavior is expressions like this join E, with E evaluating to some valid thread ID. So what would you assume that this does? Well, this depends on the current state of the computation. So with the thread that is associated with this thread ID is already terminated, well, we can just return its return value that we can still read off from whatever the thread table points to. This stack pointer there still contains the final result in there. Yeah. If it's not terminated yet, well, this is a good situation where we can just interrupt the current thread execution, since join would like to continue only when the other thing has already terminated. But we would still need to make sure that the execution actually really continues whenever the other thing terminates. So we would have to keep queues for other threads that can be entered when you are interested in waiting for the result of that particular thread. So, yeah, that is this point. Of course, well, yeah, and then there's the usual switch to the next thread, which is not so important here. So we need some facility to actually really keep track of who waits for whom. So this is a thing that we tackle within a new facility in our virtual machine, which is this JTAP thing that is the join table. So this is where we can actually find the threads that are interested in my result whenever I terminate. So, as an example, how this might look like. So there's this join table, and the current thread and the ready queue. So currently running is thread 0. There's nothing interesting for thread 0 in the join table so far, so this is not particularly interesting. Then there is thread 1, which is in the ready queue, so it could potentially run, but does not so far. It has an entry in the join table. And there's threads 2 and 3 waiting for the termination for thread 1. Thread 2 has at some point, it seems, already terminated, and there's no one really registered for this thing anymore. Then there is thread 3. Well, there's no one registered. It has not terminated. It's still active in the waiting queue on thread 1, it seems. So thread 2 is, in that sense, not ready just. Thread 3 is also not ready, is also present in the waiting queue for thread 1, and has another thread waiting for it in its own join queue, which is thread 4, which itself doesn't have anything that interests thread 4, that is interested in thread 4. So this is how you could read such a situation here. And, well, let's have a look at how an instruction like this join now can be brought into that system. So the expression looks like this thing here, join E, which, again, first of all, is the plain old evaluation of an expression for obtaining the thread ID. And then there's these two special purpose instructions, join and finalize. With, well, what is that? What join does? Join first of all obtains the thread ID, which we have immediately before already stored on the stack. and then looks it up in the thread table in order to with this what is this, the zeroth entry in the thread table. I guess nobody really remembers. It's the stack pointer, I think. So look back. What was the thread table all about? Oh, it's even the frame pointer. Okay. So the frame pointer is checked whether it's larger than zero, and this is usually the sign whether the thread has already been popped completely from its stack or not. And if that is larger than zero, then the thread is usually still running. So this is the check for the thread actually being still alive. And if it is still running, then what is done is you enqueue your current thread to the join table of the desired thread in its first element. So this is keeping the table, the queue, the waiting queue. And then what is done is we dispatch execution to the next waiting thing in the waiting queue via next without entering ourselves, and then terminate the whole thing. If the thread is not alive anymore, we just plainly fall through whatever comes behind that, which would usually be the finalize, which is also called whenever the thread reawakes. So finalize, what could that be? Well, if join just registers ourselves to be interested in the termination of the thing and then dispatches control away, and then only returns whenever the thing is terminated, this is probably the place for retrieving the actual result of the thread. So this is what finalize then actually does. So this will just set the top of the stack to whatever is contained in the zeroth or first component in that sense of the join table. So not the the waiting queue for the joining queue, but instead the first field, which is the one that is responsible for containing the result of the whole thing. So yeah, you might wonder how we can actually find the result of the computation in there. Well, you might remember what we did when we terminated a particular thread. We had this sequence of term and next in the very end, and this is what is executed before a thread is actually terminated. And the term thing was the one that we didn't focus on before, but now let's do. So the next thing is the one that that switches to the next executable thread. But what still needs to be done is that the last stack needs to be last stack frame needs to be popped, and the result needs to be written to the J table at zero, because this is where everyone else accesses the result. So this is what needs to be done before. Also, the thread needs to be marked as terminated with this frame pointer being set to -1, and we need to actually really notify the threads that have been waiting for termination. So this is what this term could then just take as responsibility. So what that means is that there's particular needs for term to actually do. So we flag the execution to be done by setting the frame pointer to -1. We transfer the result to the join table. We perform the actual free stack routine, which is a new thing that does what the name suggests. So free stack will, at a particular address, will take away everything from the address and removes that from the internal registry of stacks. And the only thing that remains now is to look at the process of informing all the interested joiners, and well, that is done by iteratively dequeuing from the joint queue in the join table and in queue whatever you get from there to the ready queue, RQ. So with that, you have moved every joiner into the ready queue and done with that. Good. So the next thing would be to talk about mutual exclusion, but since that is a rather large topic, and we actually have plenty of time left in the next few lectures, I think we can just at that point say let's skip that for next time and terminate here. So have a nice week and see you next week.